Your microphones are live.
Okay. Good morning and welcome to the December 6, 2011 San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. Would you please join us in the flag salute?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thanks very much. Madam Clerk, any changes to our agenda today?
There are none.
Thank you. All right. With that, we will move into our consent agenda. I do have one request to speak from the public. Our esteemed county surveyor, Mr. Ryan. Good to see you, Doug.
Good morning. Good morning, board members. Doug Ryan, county surveyor. Just want to bring your attention to a correction to item 11 on your consent agenda today. Sheet 11.5, a graphic exhibit of existing parcels. The acreage is incorrect. There's a parcel there shown as 88.93 acres. It should be 98.93 acres. And then also on sheet 11.7, staff report refers to a parcel of 89.93 acres, and that again should read 98.93 acres. And I've given corrected sheets to the clerk this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Okay, I have no further requests from the public to speak on consent, so I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board and see if my colleagues have some items they'd like questions or comments on. I'll start with Mr. Meacham.
None, sir.
Mr. Gibson.
No, thank you, sir.
Mr. Teixeira.
No.
And Mr. Patterson.
None this morning.
And I have none, so with that I'll
approve.
Okay.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Meacham, second by Supervisor Teixeira to approve with the noted changes from our surveyor. Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Teixeira.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes, thank you. All right, we're going to get into a present, because we have a shorter meeting today, we're going to do our presentation now. Before public comment, and we do have a presentation. Should we have it here?
We're gonna
honoring one of our esteemed employees, and do we have anyone that's? I'm not sure who we have speaking on behalf. This is for Patrick Leeser.
We have.
Guys have
General Services Director.
Okay.
Is here?
Can I have a motion? Yeah.
And IT.
Okay, yes, that's right. We need a motion on, I forgot.
So moved.
Okay, moved by Supervisor Gibson, second by Supervisor Meacham. Roll call, Madam Clerk, please, on the presentation calendar.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Ma'am.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, this is a resolution which I'll read. For Patrick, am I saying this correctly just to make sure, Mr. Savage, Patrick Leeser?
Mm-hmm.
And okay, I just want to make sure. This is recognizing Patrick's 30 years of service here with our county. Whereas Patrick Leeser has worked for the County of San Luis Obispo since 1981 within information technology, encompassing 30 years of employment for his retirement on December 10th, 2011. That would be this week. Whereas Patrick became a certified information system security professional and designed, implemented, and maintained the county's information security program. I think we have a quick photo after you shake hands, and then we'll let your get in here, Patrick, and we'll get a photo for posterity. Okay, and we'll let some you can man this lectern and you'll go last. We'll give you the last word since you're retiring and heading off onto a sailboat, which sounds pretty darn good. Ms. Pell.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the board. Jeanette Pell, General Services Agency Director. It is a pleasure to be here today to recognize Patrick Leeser for his 30 years of dedicated county service. Today, we honor Patrick as he prepares for retirement, and we celebrate an extremely successful career. The resolution just read highlighted just a few of the many milestones and accomplishments Patrick has achieved since he started in the county in 1981. You could not ask for a better employee than Patrick. Some of the characteristics that come to mind when I think of Patrick are his vast knowledge and technology, his enthusiasm, especially when he's had coffee, his integrity, his willingness to be a mentor, and his dedication to public service. Patrick had a vision for making technology available within the county. Through his research and creative implementation of technology, Patrick was instrumental in making San Luis Obispo County a recognized leader throughout the state. Patrick has developed lasting relationships with people from IT organizations throughout the state, as well as right here at the county. Today is filled with mixed emotions. Patrick will be missed by his county family, and we want him to know we appreciate all that he has done. On behalf of the General Services Agency, Information Technology, and the County of San Luis Obispo, I want to thank you for your outstanding county service and wish you the best as you enter into retirement. And I do want you to enjoy that new grandson, and I do want you to enjoy that new sailboat, and I especially want you to be golfing on county golf courses. So good luck, best wishes, and congratulations.
Thank you. I knew there was a catch.
And Mr. Savage, did you want to throw in a few salutary comments here for Mr. Leeser?
Good morning. Guy Savage, Deputy Director, General Service Agency. Patrick, it's been a great 10 years. I've had the distinct pleasure, and I do mean that but from the bottom of my heart, to have Patrick reporting to me for nearly a decade. Jeanette mentioned service to the county, and I don't think you would find anyone who's more dedicated to service to the public, to his friends, to his family, to his church. It's rare that you find someone with that sort of dedication. So, Patrick, can't tell you how much we're going to miss you around here. The leadership you brought to my organization, as we've covered a lot of ground in the last 10 years. It's amazing how far we've come. Jeanette mentioned some of the things Patrick's done at the state level. We, of course, have a security program here. You may not realize that Patrick helped put that in place, not just here, but we were the model for the rest of the state, and most of the other counties out there use policies that Patrick wrote. And that's a great personal achievement, I think. I guess I just want to conclude by saying, Patrick, we will miss you. Your leadership will be sorely missed. It's been an honor to call you a colleague, but I think even more importantly to call you a friend. So good luck in the future. Thanks.
That's nice. Patrick, we're going to give you the final word.
Thank you. Patrick Leeser, IT, one last time, I guess. The IT at this level, this corporate enterprise level, is truly a team sport. It really is. We do some very large projects, and none of them would have been accomplished without my colleagues, some of whom are in the audience. And it's been a great run. I really, really enjoyed that. And also including the customer staff. Today's projects are very customer-based, and the customer has as many, if not more, hours than we put into these IT projects, so thanks to our customer base. For me personally, I've had the ability to perform, supervise, and manage pretty much every job in the shop, I think, over 30 years. So it's been my pleasure to do so, and I thank you for allowing me to do that. Also, as I've got to stand on the shoulders of those who came before me, they laid some great groundwork. I mean, IT's been around a while now, so I'm not the first in the door, nor will I be the last out the door. But I have to thank all those folks ahead of me. And also for my stewardship of these positions I've gotten hold, including this one. It's been great, a great run. I know we only have these jobs for a season, all of us, and it's been really great that you trusted me with that. And lastly, I'd like to thank my family. They've been very supportive for those late-night phone calls, those 2, 3 a.m. calls when something didn't go quite right, that weekend work we got to put in implementing projects for Monday's staff to go to work on. So it's been great, and thank you all.
To check that slide. It was not created by experts, as they claimed. It was actually a Photoshop of several experts taken out of context. If you read the mini studies on groundwater, whenever they look at a supply and demand based on pumping and supply, they always go and immediately check that by looking at the amount of water in the ground over the same time period to see if the same amount of water is either missing or added. If you take NCSD's slide and add up the amount of the shortage, it equals 100,000 acre feet, which is a substantial amount for a 120,000 acre foot gas tank, if you will. If you go to NCSD's big slide here on the bottom, That's their own experts' determination of how much water we have in storage from, January of this year. And you go back the 27 years that they claimed we have a shortage and then subtract the 100,000 acre feet. That basically takes us from where we were to where we should be right now. You can see that we're not there at all. In other words, NCSD has completely misrepresented the fact that we're using twice as much as the dependable yield. And there's no basis for the supplemental water. And then unfortunately, you guys have an integrated regional water management plan. And the funding for that also comes from grant funding, which is part of the Los Osos and the NEPOMO. And if that's based on a misrepresentation, I think that threatens all of the funding in the county. So I think it's very important that you look at whether this is correct or not and correct your integrated regional water management plan and your funding requests. You can check all of my numbers. They're on the web. They're all from documents from NCSD or the other agencies. And if you have any questions, I'd answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Ms. Taylor, followed by Dan Duvall, please.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos. The sewer project, as we have been told, was the institution of water, nitrates in the water. Because of the nitrates in the water, we are going to have a multimillion dollar sewer project that may not even address the problem as it exists. Unfortunately, there is no base for how many nitrates or how much nitrate is in the water because it has not been, shall we call it, tested since 2006. At the Regional Water Quality Control Board on Thursday, the question came up why. There was no one there to answer. If you continue to address the nitrates problem without addressing the saltwater intrusion problem, you are putting in a sewer that is going to fail. Saltwater will not go through a sewer plant as nitrates would. In Los Osos on Friday, there was a hearing by the PUC, and the purpose of the hearing was to increase Golden State Water's costs. Not their costs, but their budget. The monies that come in to those that are invested in Golden State. The increase in 08 by Golden State was to cover the following: the Rosina property development of a 40,000 gallon water tank, a 512 square foot building, a pad for ion exchange removal, and there was also a process in which Golden State was going to include a pipeline from the Edna Valley to Los Osos for additional water. It's all in their budget. It was in the 2010-2011 budget. This alone would require a permit for those in this board to review, yet none of us have seen any of the review of any of this development. Ion exchange can be done at the waterhead, at the wellhead. Why not start there and test how much nitrate there is in the water today? It hasn't been tested for a very long period of time. The State Regional Water Quality Control Board has not intervened yet, but the Regional Water Board has. A number of persons at the water board questioned why this had not been done.
And anytime your board makes a variance, that's thinking outside the box. There's other towns like Fresno, Santa Barbara, and in the case of Katrina, We've used patterns outside the box to come up with shelter for the people that very much need it. Any thought you gentlemen could give to this, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duvall. And I have, just for the record, I have worked with Mr. Grant, and I think we're going to work with the city to provide some funding for the shelter. Is that right, Mr. Grant?
That is correct, and I hope to have that resolved by today.
Okay, excellent. So we are going to do what we can to make sure there is a warming shelter in these difficult nights. Mr. DeFatta, followed by Jerry Walsh, please.
I second Mr. Duvall's suggestion. Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Hill, Board, Sheriff, and Public. Ben DeFatta here from the bankrupt community of Supervisor Gibson's District 2 bedroom town of Los Osos, where you can rent a bedroom for $400 a month, because that's all many can afford. I was looking over the tape of the May 2011 Supervisor's meeting where the Los Osos Sewer Project was on the agenda. Mr. Gibson was looking for another installment of $5 million to spend for another redesign of his flawed gravity collection project. After the dozen of us use up our 3 minutes trying to convince you five that his gravity project is unaffordable and the wrong one for a little town sitting on a sand dune, you voted yes and put us into more debt. After Mr. Gibson pleaded his case for the $5 million, Supervisor Patterson spoke up and said, this sewer project has taken up 15, 20 years, and he will vote for it no matter what the cost. Just get her done. He voted for the $5 million study because this sewer needs to be built soon. He didn't care how many people who can't pay for this gravity project that will be thrown out of their homes, or about the damage a large earthquake would do to the deep trench big pipe gravity collection project that would end up leaking into our only drinking water aquifer. We could not rebut their thinking because we had already used up our 3 minutes. What a lame excuse to say, especially when Supervisor Patterson and Hill is up for re-election next year. Whoever heard of building a big $200 million project without an affordability and seismic study? I can't figure out how they got a $86 million loan and who is going to do the foreclosures. I remind you all of the final decision for the now miserable failed Tri-W Disaster Treatment Plant was also approved by the Planning Commission and upheld by both the Supervisors and Coastal Commission. That was in 3 and 4. Now, where is the Tri-W sewer disaster these days? In hell, I hope. Well, let's see. First, I remind you, even the CSD took the project away from the county because their gravity collection was unaffordable then and still is today, because it is still Ogren's same old unaffordable gravity project. The county always had the final say, even when the Los Osos CSD was going to build it. And today it is still Gibson and Ogren's unaffordable, antiquated, energy hog, stinking gravity collection project that can't pass muster. Let's see how many costly changes these two have made. The Midtown site for the treatment plant was a bad idea. The site near homes, businesses, towns, and our only part. The Broderson disposal recharge site was wrong because it eventually would have caused an ambulance destroying property and many lives. Then they moved it to the Tonini Ranch, consisting of 640 acres for a treatment plant and disposable spray field. It was another costly and time-consuming flawed idea by Gibson and Ogren, and the wasting of our only drinking water that would never be seen again. No affordability study, no seismic study, no town hall meeting.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta.
To show other cheaper and better alternatives.
Ms. Walsh, followed by Richard Margetson, please.
Good morning, Jerry Walsh. Please bear with me. This may be a little long, but it's for a good cause throughout the entire county. In 2006, those who sat at this board proclaimed that year and every year thereafter Homeless Awareness Week, the second week in December, and Richard will talk about why the need is so great. You may all be aware of this event, but many here in the audience today and those watching at home are not aware. You can do something to help, though. Before you go to the Sea Pines Golf Course Resort Snow Day with real snow to play in from 1 to 7 in Los Osos, where part of the proceeds go to the Special Olympics, please come to the 6th Annual Needs and Wishes Holiday Fundraiser for the Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter this coming Saturday, December 10th, right after the Los Osos Chamber of Commerce Christmas Parade. It will be at the South Bay Community Center at 2180 Palisades Avenue, corner of Los Osos Valley Road, behind the skate park. Come either before 10 a.m. or after 10:30 a.m. because Los Osos Valley Road will be blocked off for the parade. We are having an open house all day from 10 a.m. until our silent auction ends at 6 p.m. or $43,000. I think you'll be overwhelmed at the holiday spirit when you step in the room. You can buy food at Rudolph's Kitchen, dollar hot dogs, $2 hamburgers, $3 veggie burgers, bakery to eat or take home at Mrs. Claus's Baked Goods. The Pie Man of Slow Baked Bakery will be there donating his pies, and we can still use more cookies if you like to bake. Again, the dynamic Gary Freiberg will be our master of ceremonies, and Santa will be there for you to take pictures with the children. The whole event will be televised live by our wonderful AGP video on Channel 20 all day in Los Osos. And our live entertainment is amazing. This year, new to this event, is the Trinity Methodist Church handbell ringers starting the program at 11:15. If you have never heard handbells before, come see this group. They're really enchanting. Then right out of Glee comes Colleen Walls, Los Osos Middle School Stage Choir at 12:15, and her Morro Bay High School Chamber Choir at 12:45. They're both in their sixth year of participating with us. Ann Tiber has organized her famous friends to entertain us from 2 to 3:30. The Bay Osos International Folk Dancers, also in their sixth year of performing, will be led by Ann and Jean Wheeler. Irish step dancer Tiffany Farrell will merrily dance to Jingle Bells. New this year will be the Scottish Highland Dancers, led by Brian Evans. The Argentine Tango, done by Christina and Tom Traxel, will heat up the stage. Then that very hot Scottish band, the Gilly Weasels, led by Guy Wallace, are going to rock the house. Everyone will be invited to join in and do the White Christmas Hula. And last but certainly not least, at 5 p.m., the adorable Baywood Elementary School, led by Gordon Snap, in their sixth year of participating, will remind us of the meaning of the holidays. The silent auction ends at 6 p.m. sharp. Raffle winners will be announced. Bidders can go to the back tables at the back of the room to find out if they won and pay for their items until 8 p.m. or on Sunday from 10 until 3. People are donating and attending from throughout the entire county, especially those who have come before and know just how special and heartwarming the day is. So bring your change to help fill the two 5-gallon jugs at the event. They hold about $1,000 each when filled. If you cannot attend but would like to donate, please make a check out to Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter and mail to P.O. Box 6721, Los Osos, California, 93412, so that it counts towards matching funds. Thank you for your patience. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Mr. Margerson, please, followed by Mr. Barrow.
Green button.
Richard Margerson, following up on what Jerry started, also have to thank all of the volunteers that work on this event and that man a station at the event. Some of them have done it every year. Some of them won't give up their station even if asked. And she forgot to mention that the big prize this year on the raffle will be an Xbox 360. 20% of the proceeds again this year will go towards the building of a new shelter. This past year, with help from you gentlemen and many other dedicated individuals throughout the county, the land has been secured. It's the property next to the Department of Social Services. Silent fundraising campaign is going on now. Gentlemen from Los Osos who, when we started this event the second year, approached me and indicated that if there was ever the real possibility of building a new shelter, he would be interested in donating $50,000 a year for 4 years. Recently, a number of us met with him, and I understand his first check has been dispersed, and I know there's other people in the county that have been making contributions to that effort. The need is great. You've heard about it. You've read about it in the paper. We all know it's there. When we started this event 6 years ago, the enumeration study stated that there were roughly 2,400. The number is up to 3,800 now. Sometimes I question whether we're making any progress, but I do believe we've raised the awareness with everybody's participation and commitment to solving this problem. I'm going to just leave you with all charities are valuable to the human condition, but this time of year, especially this time of year, especially in this economy, those charities that are providing food and shelter, I think, deserve our support above and beyond all others.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. And Richard Margerson is right. There is more pressure on people to stay in their housing. We're about to see a tax revolt in Los Osos. And I remind you of our country's beginning as we freed ourselves from the tyranny and taxes of Great Britain. The tax the county is placing on Los Osos citizens is not bearable. So many people will have to leave if it takes place. Many residents can't afford $250 a month alongside other utility bills. Up on the screen, I have a breakdown. The collection cost for the gravity, as you presented it on Monday to the State Revolving Fund for the 0% loan, which you were not awarded, is $104 million for the collection system alone. The step collection system for the same in-street pipings and connections up to septic tanks, basically the same project, except that it includes the laterals, is $10 million. A $94 million burden, unnecessary. Just not necessary. We're not here to enrich anybody. We're here to comply with the law. The law says we can't discharge from our septic tanks. $94 million waste. It's just inconceivable that that would take place. You told us that you would have a competitive bidding in the 218 vote. And then you took the step stake off the table, the $90 million cheaper project. That was a lie. You lied to us. You all approved that lie. You need to think about that. The step withstands the gravity, the ground motion in an earthquake, as demonstrated in Christchurch, New Zealand earthquake. The gravity sewer pipeline was destroyed. The trenchless technology or shallow trenches avoids utilities. That technology was used by the gas company to install their gas lines similarly. My source is the County of San Luis, and the SEP collection source is from Caltrans contractor Dalio. Thank you, and have a good holiday.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Mr. Brown, followed by Jeff Edwards, please.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. Tomorrow on your SLOCOG agenda, you have a long agenda, but one of the key items is a report from your consultant about the results of a poll on the feasibility of sales tax for transportation at several levels. And it's relevant for the Board of Supervisors in this room because many of the questions and results in that poll go to the heart about what people think about smart growth, now strategic growth. And in that poll, it shows that overwhelmingly 80% of the respondents, and they had looked at it a couple of three ways, were concerned about improving the local economy. And 75% ranked balancing local government budgets. And to get to the next highest thing, you had to go down to 62%, which said maintaining roads and filling potholes was the next highest thing. And significantly, a number of the smart growth iconic policies rank much lower. So, for example, providing safer bike routes and sidewalks got 38%, expanding passenger train services 30%, improving local and regional bus services 30%, and relieving countywide traffic congestion 28%. Now, mind you, this is an expert poll by an expert scientific polling firm that SLOCOG invested quite a bit of money in. Significantly, and in conclusion, the consultants found that the results of the poll clearly indicate that voters are preoccupied with the economy and jobs, are uneasy about their ability to afford additional taxes, and have diminished confidence that tax revenues would be spent well. End quote. Now, this isn't the first poll. Back in 2005, the Board of Supervisors conducted a small poll preparatory to kicking off the whole climate change smart growth effort. And that poll...
Second, the Public Utilities Commission held a series of hearings in Los Osos to consider a rate case that was presented by the Golden State Water Company. The Golden State Water Company is one of the two main water purveyors in Los Osos, and is a member of the ISJ, which you've in the past heard about that. The ISJ is charged with slowing the advance of seawater intrusion in our groundwater base, in our main groundwater base, in the Paso Robles Formation. Well, Supervisor Gibson was in attendance, of course, and by the press accounts, David Snead of the Tribune wrote a piece, and there's an apparent contradiction. Mr. Snead, in his write-up, says that Mr. Gibson indicated that the company, Golden State Water Company, has not yet given sufficient justification for the rate hikes. And, again, there's an apparent contradiction in that Supervisor Gibson knows full well that by design, the work associated with water resources has been delegated to them. And it was delegated to them at the time the wastewater project was advanced by the county. So they've asked for money to make needed infrastructure improvements, which in part will fulfill the basin management plan that's being prepared in accordance with the ISJ. So I'm just curious what Supervisor Gibson's position is on this. It's not the first time Golden State Water Company made application. They had a rate case pending 18 months ago, is my recollection, or thereabouts. And at the time, Supervisor Gibson wrote a letter, penned a letter that objected to their rate increase, again, is my recollection. And again, the contradiction. These, again, are the folks that are charged with implementing projects or to do the very thing that Supervisor Gibson delegated to them. So the seawater intrusion issue is becoming increasingly important. We've done very little, if anything, to combat it, and something needs to be done. It doesn't appear to be connected to the wastewater project, and so really what is going to happen? At a minimum, we have mixed signals being sent, and worse, it's a real contradiction, and perhaps on political grounds. So I would hope that Supervisor Gibson would clarify his position on the rate case that Golden State is proposing why they haven't made the sufficient justification for the funds that they're seeking to implement measures that, again, he has set them up for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Ms. Tacker, followed by Lindy Owen, please.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos. I'd like to speak to the yesterday, I understand, the State Water Resources Control Board authorized a 2% interest rate on an enormous loan for the wastewater project. September 20th was the last time your board had any sort of update on the wastewater project. I think it might have been touched on briefly at that time, but some months have passed, and I think there'd been ample opportunity for you to take this up in discussion. Since that meeting, the county submitted information to the regional or the state water board staff that that operates the state revolving fund supporting three reduced rate interest scenarios. Back in March, our supervisor and our public works department, along with the Dirty Dozen that you see here on Tuesdays, was up in Sacramento, and we all agreed that Los Osos needs a low interest rate and the best possible rate for that money, that tremendous amount of money. The three scenarios that Public Works put forward, scenario A, 2% interest for 10 years, followed by a 2.6% interest rate for 20 years. Scenario B, 1% interest for 10 years, followed by 2.6% interest for 20 years. Scenario C, 0% interest for 10 years, followed by 2.6% interest rate for 20 years. That should have been reversed. The very first thing they should have asked for was 0%. But they should have gone the extra mile and asked for 0% for the life of the loan. The missed opportunity by your board, by that staff, by my community, was that we could have all sang a very united song asking for the lowest possible interest for the longest possible period to help the citizens of Los Osos. I'm dumbfounded why the Public Works Department didn't come to your board for direction. I believe
Sacramento hearings and proposed that we could take a 2% or a 1% instead of saying we have to have a 0%. The State Water Board issued an illegal loan in the first place that began the project. They issued funds ahead of time. None of what has cost us money right now would even be happening. We would be starting with a clean slate. At Regional Water Quality Control Board last week, again, the questions came up about the nitrate testing and the actual serious problem of the saltwater intrusion being this, the supreme problem here. Nitrates are minimal at this point. We are like 1% over the rate, and there is no other city on the coast that has anything, has lower nitrates than Los Osos. So let's put the scenario straight and address building a sewer for saltwater intrusion. Now, the only way to do that is to do a phased system. And a phased system simply means that you start out and you take the low-lying problem areas, you address them first, while you then reevaluate how you're going to solve saltwater intrusion problems and provide enough water for the existing community, at least without importing Nacimiento water. This project is designed, as proposed by Mr. Gibson and Mr. Ogren, has been designed to actually import Nacimiento water at the tail end. This isn't any benefit for Los Osos. It may bring in new property taxes in the future, but it is totally against sustainable design and building. Basically, it's eminent domain by taxation. You put forward a project that we can't afford. When we can't afford it, you take our houses away. It's also public waste. We've wasted 5 years and, I don't know, $12 million for Mr. Pava Ogren to come up with what should have been a one-year process and should have cost $1 million, no more, to look at the two systems that were before us. As Mr. Barrow pointed out, $10 million to build the pressure collection system versus $104 million to build the one that's proposed. And then in the paper today, it even talks about Mr. Gibson going on the seismic study for the PUC to look at the Diablo stuff. If he can't see the probability of the breakage of that kind of system that is proposed, this big gravity, outrageously expensive, a gravity system going into Los Osos, one earthquake, and we're done for. That whole system is garbage. We're in a liquefaction zone, for God's sakes. There's two of them in the whole county.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. Wynn, followed by Eric Greening, please.
Good morning, Chairman Hill, Supervisors. My name is Mike Wynn, and I'm wearing the hat this morning as Chair of your Water Resource Advisory Committee. As is usual, we will be meeting tomorrow. It's the first Wednesday of the month, and we normally have our meetings in the afternoon of that. But tomorrow we're going to be starting at 9 o'clock and having a workshop on the Integrated Regional Water Management Plan. We'll look at a number of things, including the possibilities of getting some more state funds, but this time for planning, not for projects. But these are things that we'll be looking at in the morning. You're certainly welcome in your busy day. If you would care to stop by, we would give you every courtesy and let you speak to the folks there. In the afternoon, we will have our regular meeting. The big item on the afternoon meeting is consideration of the Public Works budget for this next year, giving some idea of how we see priorities and what things we think you might want to consider. And one of the issues, of course, is to see whether or not we should be budgeting an update for the regional, resource capacity study that was done for the Paso Robles Basin. Now, I know it was done not long ago, but because of limited funds and timing, we only had data through 1997. And so that study, as good as we could make it, is still 14 years old in terms of the data. Your department is gearing up to handle better data better, and we think that an update quickly would make it even more useful, both to your staff and to all the stakeholders in North County that are looking at voluntary efforts to help solve this problem. So those are things we'll be looking at. I'm not asking you to give us advice about what advice to give you. But I am saying
that would simplify things, Mr. Wynn.
But I am saying that if you have questions or concerns that you would like for us to be throw in the hopper tomorrow, there's still time to get those in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Mike, and if you would, we will be busy tomorrow with COG and RTA all day, but if you would send this board's gratitude to the RAC for the hard work that they do and the good advice that they provide to us, we would appreciate it because we are very, very appreciative of your work and your members' work.
They're a remarkable group of people. We're very fortunate to have them.
Please thank them for us. Thank you. Mr. Greening, followed by Lionel Johnston, please.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, running in the mid to low 20s, 22 to 24 range of late. Try spending a night outside up there yourselves, and you'll see what I mean. There are a lot of people doing just that. Anyway, my main comment is we got some alarming news on the global front. 2010 saw the fastest increase in global warming gases of any year over any year. Serious, serious issue. So I would like to thank you for 2 weeks ago enacting the Climate Action Plan, the EnergyWise Plan. Now is the time to lean forward into the implementation. There are some great policies in there. I know that I drew attention to a few shortcomings here and there, but it's mostly excellent policies that we need to move forward with. When are we going to start seeing projects coming forward, for example, with the parking costs unbundled so that people who don't drive don't have to subsidize the people who do? We didn't get that in Templeton, which was our last sort of semi-strategic growth project. As a matter of fact, that was supposed to be a transit-oriented project from which operating cuts in transit service have removed the nearby transit. As that gets built now, there is no public transit in downtown Templeton, only on the west side of the freeway. And yet this county still diverts a considerable amount of its LTF funding from transit to roads. And, of course, you'll be looking at roads fees later in the agenda when they should be transportation fees. So we need to start implementing right away. Anyway, thank you for enacting it, and now let's move forward with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Lionel?
Yeah, thanks, Eric, for bringing up that report that was released about the global warming and the insane increase in CO2. Of course, most of it was in the third world, where they're getting first world, but still, the U.S. and Europe, even with its efficiencies, is as far out does everybody else in the world in climate changing gases. But I wanted to say thanks to Bob Hamilton and the crew out at Whale Rock Reservoir for letting us go out there and plant trees. Last Saturday, Cameron Dunn and the Cal Poly Sierra Club group with about 20 students came out, and they helped us plant a whole bunch of trees and several hundred acorns from local trees. We gathered them from, they had helped earlier. And there was about a dozen citizens there from a varied amount of place, a couple of guys from Cambria who had been working on the Fiscalini Ranch, some folks from Paso Robles, a couple of ladies from Templeton, and a guy from Morro Bay who's one of the docents, you know. And there was a cross-section of people there, and we worked really well for a couple of hours. It was a beautiful sunny day. And we're going to do it again this Saturday. It was such a fun time before the rainy season actually hits. We hope there will be a nice average rainy season. So we got all a bunch of trees in the ground. We saw like lots and lots of trees that we had planted in the past. Some of them are now 10, 12 feet tall and doing their job of providing habitat and shading the land and sucking up carbon that all of us emit, you know. That's it. It's modern civilization. As we work on these lesser polluting measures for energy, we need to plant lots and lots of trees. And so that's what we're doing out there at Whale Rock Reservoir, because it's a big open public space and there's a lot of erosion on the banks. And so it's pretty cheap, easy, doable project. It's kind of fun. I mean, it's just a beautiful place. And then to go along with that and sort of tie in with maybe a little bit of the eucalyptus thing in Los Osos, Mr. Jeff Edwards back there has grown 300 local native live oaks from Los Osos. And these are particular for that place because they grow in sandy soil. And if you try and take those seeds to San Luis Obispo, they really won't grow. And if you try and get seeds of the live oak, even though they all look the same, and take them out to the sandy soil, they won't grow. But we're going to try and give some of them away next Monday. Let's see, the 10th, from 10 o'clock to 2 p.m., we're going to be at Whale Rock Reservoir. And that's up Old Creek Road from Highway 1. And we're going to be there from 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock, and we'll provide acorns and a planting stick for people that want to come out. And then Monday, which is the 12th, from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock at Baywood Farmers Market at the corner of 2nd and Santa Maria. And this is in greater metropolitan downtown Baywood, so don't get lost. If you're coming for a free oak tree to put in your yard, and don't put it where they might dig it up and put the future sewer. But thank you very much for listening, and I hope people will come out and help us.
Thank you, Lionel. Appreciate that. That will close it for public comment, and we will move.
The Oceano Mitigation, Tom Trott is our capital projects manager who's been implementing the majority of these interim projects, and Mark Hutchinson, our Public Works Environmental Division manager, who will discuss regulatory and some permitting issues associated with the update and the status and where we're going here. We're kind of going to do a little bit of a tag team. Jill and Tom and Mark will pick it up, and I'll kind of conclude with the recommendation regarding the breaching. Jill, you going to? Okay. I'm going to do this. Okay. Today's updates are composed of basically two portions. We want to give you a status of the efforts that we have completed or are nearing completion, and then I will conclude at the end of the discussion the recommendation that's in your staff report to authorize manual breach of the southern levee to protect life and property if a failure of the north levee is imminent. Our previous board updates just briefly brought to you the Meadow Creek and Arroyo Grande Creek large picture priorities. We provided project alternatives, a number of options that we could address and accomplish. In September, we provided cost estimates and the status of those efforts and identified the 7 work priorities that we have nearly completed. And in October, your board approved funding for these efforts. Jill is going to give you an update of where we are on these efforts at this time.
Ms. Ogle?
Good morning, Chairman Hill, members of the board. Jill Ogren, Public Works. So as you can see from the screen, we've completed 5 of the 7 work priorities that were established back in September. We have 2 that we are currently working on. That's our sandbar management and the pump and pipeline alternative in the lagoon. And Tom Trott is going to give you a little update on the pump and pipeline, as well as an alternative that was brought in at the October meeting, I believe, regarding the alternative reed management, which is turning out to be maybe a potential solution or at least a good alternative to the pump and pipeline. So I'm going to turn it over to Tom for him to give you a little update on that.
Good morning. I'm Tom Trott, Public Works. And as Jill said, we've been looking at two potential temporary solutions to minimize flooding in Oceano. One, the pump and pipeline, which you know about, and the reed management, which you may or may not know too much about. The basic idea of what we're trying to do is get water out of Meadow Creek Lagoon as quickly as possible to minimize the flooding risk. And each of these solutions looks at it from a different perspective. They both acknowledge that we need to get the water out, but it also they both acknowledge that one of the significant problems with the water getting out quickly is that there's a lot of reed buildup in the lagoon, and that reed kind of acts kind of like a barrier from getting water from upper Meadow Creek Lagoon to the flapgates into Arroyo Grande Creek and out to the ocean. And so I'm going to give you kind of a quick overview of these and comparison of these two projects. The first is the reed management, and basically this is a very simple project. And what it proposes to do is to cut a big 10-foot swath through the reeds to create a channel from Upper Meadow Creek Lagoon to the flapgates so that it can really, the facility can work as it was originally designed, is the water can free flow to the flapgates. We've gotten proposals for this work, and we've pursued two solutions for this. One is hand cutting, so that we'd have somebody out there cutting the reeds by hand, and the other is mechanical means. Can you switch to the next slide? Mm-hmm. Just so you get an idea of what that looks like, some of the proposals are mechanical means, and you can see this piece of equipment here is called the Marshmaster, and you can understand why it's called the Master. It's an amphibious vehicle, which means that it can go on land or it can float. And this is actually a fairly common thing that they use all over the state and all over the country, and it's somewhat non-evasive. As you can see, the weight distribution on it is so that the ground pressures are equal to about 10% of a normal human footprint. So we're not talking about a lot of invasiveness here. And they come in, and what they would do is that little front piece on that machine cuts the reeds right at about the water level, and they can remove the reeds. And so we're looking at both solutions right now, and it's really pending on what the Coastal Commission and environmental agencies have to say about this. Now, the pump and pipeline is a little bit more complex of a project, and I'm sure you know a little bit more about that. But that involves quite a few activities and coordination, and it involves utility relocation in Juanita Avenue. It involves purchasing of HDPE pipe. It involves trenching up Juanita Avenue, installation of the pipe, then a rental agreement with a company that rents very large flood control pumps and piping. And the idea of that project would be is to pump the water down upstream of the reeds as much as possible in advance of a storm so that we could provide some capacity for water coming in a storm. We can't rent a pump large enough, a portable pump anyway, to keep up with a storm and a storm event. So this would just kind of provide some room in advance of a storm. This is a much more complex project. So as you go down the comparison chart here, we've advanced both of these projects to the point where we can just go ahead. We've gotten quotes and proposals and such. And the reed management to go and both of them help minimize the flooding risk, but I think the idea, too, is these are both temporary solutions, and we should also recognize that there's still flooding risk that exists. It doesn't eliminate flooding risk. And in events of high tides and storm swells and large storms, there's still a risk of flooding. But both of these solutions would provide some benefit as far as minimizing the flooding. So I'm going to turn it back over to Jill, and she's going to discuss some of the other things that we're working on.
So I'd like to give you a little bit more status of some of the other things we've been working on in the Oceano area. Some of them you're aware that I've updated at previous board hearings here. We've completed the ditches and culverts in the Oceano Lagoon. We've inspected them and we've cleaned them to the extent that we could with the permits. We are continuing to monitor beaver dams and downed trees in a Rio Grande channel. We plan to have a piece of equipment like an excavator stationed at the 22nd Street Bridge should there be any kind of a debris jam during storms, just knowing that we do have a number of beaver dams. And we've, as far as like removing the dams, they just simply build them right back up. So it's more of a issue of us just keeping a handle on how many there are and where they're located. We've also replaced the damaged Los Barros flap gates, which we believe were due to muskrats or beavers. And so we've actually replaced those with metal flap gates. So those are the ones down where the old Los Barros channel connects to the Rio Grande Creek channel. We are also ready to finalize our emergency response plan, which the major change to that was the inclusion of procedure for manually breaching the south levee under certain conditions. And Dean will talk more about that. We've also scheduled our annual training of our staff on how we respond in a storm event using that emergency response plan. As far as public education, last week the flood evacuation brochure looks something like this, was mailed to all the residents in Oceano. And tonight we'll be having an flood safety open house from 6 to 8 at the Oceano Community Services building where anybody can come in for as long as they would like, and we'll be there to answer questions. We've got some information on where they can, how to prepare themselves, and how the plan is operated. And in addition to that, we worked on getting some sand. We'll be providing sand at two locations for the public. One of them, Oceano Community Services District, is allowing us to put some sand on their well site, which is located on 13th Street, and as well as we will have about 10 cubic yards of sand at the in the right-of-way next to the 22nd Street Bridge. And sandbags are available at the various local businesses in town. And here's a little map showing you where the two sites are for the where our sand is going to be located, and we'll try to keep that there should the need arise for, hopefully not, but just in case. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Mark Hutchinson, who's going to be giving you a status on the environmental permits on the sandbar management, potentially the reeds, and other items.
Thank you, Jill. Members of the board, Mark Hutchinson, Department of Public Works, Environmental Division Manager. On the slide now is our now familiar chart showing status of environmental regulatory permits and where we are with those. The green represents those that are issued, and the yellow is those that are not. I would point out that for sandbar management, pump and pipeline, those from the onset were intended to be emergency permits if needed. We know that the process to obtain regular permits is about a 2 to 3 year process. I've added reed management to that list, and note that there is substantially less regulatory involvement with that kind of a project that's been proposed. In talking about those three in the yellow zone, the first is sandbar management. This is a fairly recent picture of the sandbar showing a Rio Grande Creek lagoon. The lagoon in October was open and has generally been so all summer long. There's substantially less sand on the beaches this year than in past years, so the lagoon hasn't been closed for any appreciable time frame. In fact, if we eventually do get our sandbar management program put together, the focus of that program would be to make the sandbar look like it does today. You can see there at the south there's a wide, flat opening with a thread of spons. I have some information after this meeting to share with Coastal Commission staff. They've circulated it to their biologists and their management. How should I say? And the response was not negative. they don't do positive responses, so we're doing good. We've got some dry weather here, and we hope to be able to initiate that that project as soon as possible. If we can get the agencies comfortable, we'll be doing some biological surveys in the lagoon using my staff in the next week or two, just to get some more background information to make those agencies feel a bit more comfortable about the process. But as Tom mentioned, this should be a valuable project to do, and one that is more likely to be permitted in advance of having to do work. So we wouldn't be looking for an emergency permit per se, but something on the way of a maintenance type exemption. Also easier for the agencies to deal with. The pump and pipeline at Meadow Creek Lagoon, again, would be an emergency permit. This graphic that Jill and Tom prepared simply shows that after doing their bathymetric surveys and looking at underground utilities and several other issues, the preferred route for that would be on Juanita Avenue. The pipeline under Juanita, in order to allow people to still access their homes, would have to be buried. A large pipe, but a shallow trench, owing to some of the lead time for that. And then, of course, across the beach, it would be placed on the surface. This one, in an emergency situation, actually would be not difficult to permit. The problem is the six-week lead time to put all the pieces together and get it in the ground. We're actively speaking with our planning department and coastal staff about some pre-work if we decide to do it. It looks like we should be able to get that ready to go if necessary. And then as an update on other activities, this also, by the way, is an October aerial photo of the lagoon. You can see blockage with reeds there through the flow paths, both at the top of the photo and then the lower left. We have circulated an RFP and received proposals to do a comprehensive biological survey of the lagoon. We're negotiating with the top-ranked consultant at this time on the final details of scope and cost. Interesting to note that while Oro Grande Creek has a tremendous amount of information that I could use to support permits, there are no comprehensive or even minor surveys of this part of the lagoon telling us what's there. So we'll get that work done post-haste. With that, I'll turn it back to Dean to talk about the action item for today's agenda.
Yes, a little bit of an introduction or background. The south levee overtopping is really the sticky issue here we want to address today. The hydraulic analysis that we did for the Roy Grande Creek Waterway Management Program, which we are near obtaining permits for, identified the conditions under which that flows would exceed the capacity of the channel flowing out over adjacent property. These conditions were the driver for creating, permitting, and implementing our waterway managed program, which the board has already approved. At the same time, the EIR for the waterway management plan points out the kind of impacts that could result from an overtopping event. Significantly, impacts to public safety and life and other resources could be reduced if the overtopping were controlled to the degree that we can control it. The first action to mitigate this has already been taken, which is the north levee has been raised and is protecting the majority of the residential areas on the north side. It's approximately 4 to 6 inches minimum higher than the south levee. Staff has identified additional action that could be taken in the event conditions threaten the integrity of the north levee or if overtopping of the south levee is already beginning to occur. That is a controlled breach of the south levee to eliminate that pressure to the north. These programs and these activities are consistent with the termination of the 1959 agreement with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, acknowledging that the intended purpose of the levee project has been fulfilled and the district can no longer perform the maintenance of the silt, debris, and vegetation from the channel as it was agreed upon in the 1959 agreement. The proposal that we bring to you today is recommended for authorization to breach the south levee when there's an imminent danger of the north levee being breached. When we would do this certainly is to protect life if the northern levee west of Highway 1 is in danger of overtopping or failing. There's scenarios that are sort of contingency scenarios, whether it be piping that we haven't been able to identify through the levee itself, whether there be debris that builds up, some type of a crack or unsettlement in the levee itself that we're not aware of. We have cleaned the northern levee as best as we can. There, we could have equipment available and ready to go that we could reach the levee if necessary. That we have found in our recent calculations will lower the downstream water level approximately a foot. Now, it was kind of surprising to us that that's all that would go down. The levee there is approximately 4 feet high above adjacent ground, so effectively we can only reduce the levee height 4 feet. So depending on the storm intensity, the water that we see coming, the status of the dam and any overflow that could potentially happen for that, when we recognize that this can reduce the pressure on the levee and the height of water only a foot, we evaluated that we should be considering having a second breach location, which would protect the sanitation district and the Aloha Court airport area farther west. And the location we identify and are currently working with is basically about a quarter of a mile west of the 22nd Street Railroad Bridge location. The levee here is just about 5 feet high. Again, there's a safe location. We believe we could make that breach if necessary. So these are the two locations that we have considered and are proposing. The Arroyo Grande Creek Levee Failure Emergency Response Plan, which is part of the county's emergency response plan, includes a procedure, has been updated, to include a procedure to manually breach the south levee for life safety and property protection. This would be done only if the north levee was imminently threatened, as I mentioned. This would be done in the process of evacuations being completed, the reverse 911 system implemented, sirens being sounded, and those were all in our emergency response plan as we operated it actually last year. All these evacuations would have occurred largely ahead of any type of a manual breach that would be done. And just to mention that because of the difference in the height of the levees and what we've observed basically with the levee breach that happened in 2001, the south levee starts overtopping and starts eroding the base of that out. As you know, we've put Fisqueen in an attempt to minimize the erosion that may overtop the levee location. But what we notice is that depending on the amount of rainfall or the amount of flow in the levee in the creek, it likely will be overtopping. And I think our observations were that the levee overtopped approximately at least 45 minutes to an hour, maybe several hours before it actually breached last time. So we have a little bit of time there, but that's likely the scenario that we would see before we did this. Today's recommendation before you is to authorize a manual breach of the Arroyo Grande Creek southern levee during an emergency storm response if the failure of the north Arroyo Grande Creek levee is imminent to make those protections. And we'll take any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Benedict. Mr. Patterson.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Hill. I don't know which member of staff wants to answer this question, but I'm curious about the vegetation removal potential and also the alternative where you would install pipe and then rent a pump to pump that basin. And the chart shows a significant difference in cost initially for doing that, but as we discussed this yesterday in our staff meeting, the reed removal would be an ongoing process. You'd have to do that periodically. They will grow back. And so I'm curious to know if you've assessed the fact that reed management is something that would be ongoing, and even though it's significantly less costly, for a one-time application, you'd have to do it several times, as many as two times per year to keep those channels open. And that compares to the cost of installing the pipe for the pumping mechanism. Once that's installed, it's there. I assume it will stay there. And then an ongoing cost to do that would be the cost of operating the pump and renting the pump. And what is the decision point for doing either one of those? Which practice would you actually implement and when? So could we speak to those cost differentials and ongoing need for the vegetation removal?
Yes. Now, just to make sure I understand, the vegetation removal you're mentioning is a reed management. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, not in the Arroyo Grande Canal, but in the lagoon.
Okay. The reed management we anticipate would be done frequently or intermittently. I think we understand that reeds will basically grow back probably within 3 to 4 months, maybe 6 months. They will be significantly high. They won't be back to where they were, but we would have to do that. Now, Mark, have you evaluated whether that's a permanent permit?
So really what we're looking at with the reed management with the pumping right now is the short term, what can we do for this year and the next year and perhaps the next while longer term plans come together. Those long term plans might involve some sort of pumping and piping system, either at the Juanita Street location or if channels are deepened at a different location. All of that's up in the air at this point in time.
So Mr. Patterson's question had to do with the cost as well, and I wonder if you could address that, meaning what you have quoted here for the reed management versus the pump and pipeline. Mr. Patterson asked, is that reflective of one-time reed management, or is that reflective of ongoing and how long? And
those costs reflect one time this one year, time. One time.
The bids we got for the reed management are in the range of $40,000, as Tom mentioned. That is for one time.
So subsequent efforts at reed management are going to be similarly?
That's correct. They would be of the same magnitude of cost. Now, when we started investigating a mechanized reed remover or weed whacker or whatever you want to call it, I think that machine cost about $125,000, comes from Europe to buy a machine.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look too sophisticated, but we're not sure of the operation of it. But that's a one-time cost. The cost of the pump and pipeline would be a permanent cost to purchase the pipe, which is around $30,000, relocate utilities, which is around $15,000, install the pipe in the ground and cover it up, which would be around likely $40,000. And that would be a permanent installation that we would have. In addition to that, we would have to rent the connecting piping, the temporary pump, and the discharge facility. So it would still be a pretty significant cost each year, every time we connected anything to that pipe that was in the ground, to be able to suck water out of the creek and dump it onto the beach. So my guess is that would be in a range of close to $150,000 each time we implemented that connection to our permanent installed pipe in the street.
And so I guess you're not suggesting that one or the other is more cost-effective per se?
Well, we know that if we pump water out of the lagoon and it fills up slowly, that we just got to pump it out again. It doesn't, in our perspective, really assist in letting that water flow through Meadow Creek. We believe the reed management plan, cutting those reeds down, being able to see how high the reeds, the base of them are, how high the mud level is through there, will give us some indication of where we are. We know that in the past, last year, something happened and the water flowed out and reduced to a satisfactory level. Obviously, we didn't pump the lagoon at last year. So something works well, and our belief is that the reed management will assist us with that.
Mr. Ogren?
Chairman Hill, members of the board, Bob Ogren. I think on the pumping option, one of the points to make is that even in a storm event, we don't anticipate in large storm events that the pumps would be able to keep up with the actual storm flow. That, I just want to make sure that in terms of cost effectiveness, the pipeline option is certainly a lot more costly, and even in major storm events, it won't keep up fast enough with how fast the water is moving into the lagoon.
Well, I was just going to say, we don't know. I think, and you pointed out in your staff report, that even doing the vegetation management, there's so many variables, high tide, the flow in Arroyo Grande Creek, as to whether or not the water could still evacuate the lagoon quickly enough. I mean, it's not guaranteed that either one of these measures would.
That's correct, that in either measure, there is still going to be a risk of flooding in the Middle Creek Lagoon area in the event of multiple events, high tides, a large storm swell. that essentially shuts off the flap gates. There have been some public comments that have said you just have to keep those flap gates open, and I think that it's understood that if it was just a matter of keeping the flap gates open, we wouldn't have flap gates. We'd have culverts in there. So certainly there are storm events where it creates risks to Meadow Creek. Historical documentation indicates that it happened right after the levees were constructed that following winter. Certainly it happened this last winter as well. And the idea of the reed management, at least then it would allow the free flow of water to the flap gates as was originally intended when the levees and the flap gates were constructed.
Ms. Gibson?
And just following on, I just want to be sure I understand clearly what your intention was in proceeding here. So two questions. One, it seems to me prudent to go ahead and do the upfront one-time cost to establish a pipeline in Juanita Avenue so it's available if we need to use it. And the second, and just want to confirm that was your intention. And the second question is, have you run the hydraulics on clearing the reeds to know what potential benefit that might produce?
No, the hydraulics would basically involve what the interference flow is through the creek to get to the flap gate.
Much the flow.
Right now we have water level gauges on Pier Avenue as well as on the flap gates, and there is about a foot of differential. The extent to which that's a result of the reeds versus there appears to be a beaver dam as well as in the middle of the reeds, there's a bit of uncertainty. And then in an actual flow event, to the extent that the reeds are impeding the free flow of water, it's really going to be this winter where we can start doing those evaluations as we see rainfall come in and changes in elevation. But the Pier Avenue station was put in just this last year, so we don't. There's still more analysis that we can do.
So my thoughts to colleagues to frame this is, given the unknown response of clearing reeds, I think it is prudent to be set up to do the other as well, even though it might be a more expensive proposition. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dean, does anybody else have one of these marsh masters anywhere in California they're using these?
Tom, did you? We know contractors have them and use them. I don't know if any agencies have them and use them. It's all permit driven for the most part.
I'm not aware of any agency that does. I know that that contractor is located in California and have done several projects in California with the Marshmaster, and even in Santa Cruz and near the Golden Gate Bridge and sensitive habitat. But I'm not aware of any agencies that actually have a machine.
I guess what I'm kind of looking for is, would there be a need for that in other areas of the county, which I assume there would be, for clearing in some of the creeks and some of the other areas as well? I know a lot of it has to do with the permitting issue, but it seems to me on an economy of scale that if some of the other jurisdictions, the other cities, for example, have the need for something like that, maybe a joint effort to seek something like that out.
We can investigate that. Certainly State Parks has tremendous amount of reeds in their coastal channels that may or may not benefit us or them cutting down. But we can investigate that and determine how that might be.
Then we have to go through all 11 agencies to get something done.
Mr. Teixeira, and then Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. My thoughts on this are I would go with the reed management, not because of the cost, but because of two things. It's going to help us with the management of the whole lagoon Meadow Creek area, and it may also make that area better. And I know there's been some problems down there with the water in the lagoon, with concerns about endangered species and stuff, and if we can make that area better and more viable, I think that would be the way to go. I have no problem spending the money for the pump, but I don't think that's going to be the answer, because as Mr. Ogren and the others said, we can't pump it fast enough when it starts raining. We've got to be ahead of the curve, and I think the reed management is the way to go, because if we could open up the channel and the water could move out like it's supposed to, and it has in the past, I think that'll solve the majority of the problem.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Patterson.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up with the idea of checking with other jurisdictions that have used that reed management process with the mechanical removal. We had talked about that again yesterday, and I'm curious to know if other jurisdictions have actually worked with the Coastal Commission to get the permitting needed and is the Coastal Commission familiar with this process and supportive of it? And I know Mr. Hutchinson said they didn't say no, or they didn't say yes. It's just that they didn't say no, right? So do we have that information?
The company I talked to yesterday that has the MarshMaster, they have done several projects where the Coastal Commission is involved. The projects that they did, they weren't as simple as just cutting the reeds down. They actually went as far as they have another machine that uproots the reeds. And that solution actually lasts for about 3 years before you have to come in and do anything again. And it's not just a seasonal solution. And they worked with the Coastal Commission to get permits on those, and they gave me a couple of contacts to talk further about how they did that.
Okay. Perhaps I didn't see on there, but maybe we should have a diplomatic delegation to speak to those beavers, too. Outreach to the beavers. They're causing far too much of a problem. Let's hear from the public, if we could. So I'm going to open it up. We have requests to speak from Mr. Shacker, followed by Mr. Edwards, and then followed by Mr. Cobb, please.
Good morning. One comment about Mr. Ogren. We just want the floodgates open except during the high tide. We have seen in the past where even though there's a flow from the creek and it's higher than the lagoon, it will draw out the water in the lagoon and suck it with it. But when there's high tide, we don't want the gates open. I was pleasantly surprised to see all the work done now. Not only a path cut in the lagoon to get to the floodgates, we need some paths so that the water can flow from the island. Right now, when the water saturates the ground and then it gets a heavy rain, it can't get into the lagoon fast enough, and it probably wouldn't be sucked up and pumped out fast enough either. I was all prepared to talk negative this morning, but I'm really well pleased. And I hope this goes forward. Mechanical has to be the way to go in the lagoon. I've tried myself to use things. I've waded in the lagoon and tried to clear some of those reeds myself. It's impossible. They are so heavy and so big. And I don't know why you want to cut them at water level. Cut them deeper. Cut the path. And I'm not saying destroy the lagoon, but go in there and do the job. It only has to be done once a year and probably around September before the flooding season or before the rainy season. So I wouldn't try to get too much cost built up because you have to do it frequently. I'm just a layman at all this stuff. Comment about when you talk about breaching the levee. We're out of time. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Shacker. Appreciate that. Mr. Edwards, followed by Mr. Cobb, please.
Mr. Hill, board members, good morning. My name is Jeff Edwards. I'm a 35-year resident of the county and a frequent commenter on oceanic flooding issues. I'll initiate my remarks by saying that it's not very comforting when 54 pages of a 69-page staff report is about the evacuation plan, but I guess you have to have one. In reviewing your staff report, I would like to speak to the status update on Oceano flood mitigation measures, and as the staff report indicates, there's been efforts this entire calendar year following the flood of December 19th last year. And of the seven work priorities, there's still the unfulfilled activities in Oceano. You've heard about sandbar management. That's a bit moot now since the creek is flowing to the ocean. The pump and pipeline options, I'm not sure that putting even a pump in Juanita makes any sense. I'm not sure you can even get a permit, emergency or otherwise, for that project. The outfall is a kiddie-sized pool on the beach. I don't think you can get an NPDES permit for that. So I really question that. I'm wondering, this new low-tech idea of reed management, did that come from one of the consultants? Did Cannon Engineers come up with that? Or perhaps the Philip Williams folks, the biologists, or maybe Waterway Management Inc. Or was it your public works director canoeing around in the lagoon system that had this epiphany, perhaps? I'm all for low-tech solutions, but this reed management is not engineered. You're not even sure if it's going to work. No hydraulics have been run. What's the point if it's not going to work? It certainly is cheaper than the pipe and pump. But at the end of the day, what do you really have? You've heard about other activities that have been performed. We've heard about the beavers. You're gonna put a tractor, station a tractor. Maybe that'll help. There's the flood evacuation brochure. The meeting tonight. Sand and sandbags. To me, that's all that's been accomplished. So until you look at the larger, big picture in this situation, I don't believe that there's going to be any meaningful contribution to this problem. I introduced the idea of inverse condemnation. You can't use the island and the sand district as a drainage basin. You can't do it without compensating them. So I think to just keep throwing money at bad ideas is not productive, and you really need to look at long-term solutions. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Mr. Cobb, please.
Good afternoon. I want to thank Public Works and the board for addressing this problem again. I've talked to the board in the past on this problem. I'm an Oceana resident, and it was flooded out. I'm still in the process of rebuilding my home. I have a big stake in what goes on down there. In August, we asked for some emergency or temporary measures to be put in place prior to the rainy season. And I'm a little appalled that here we are 2 weeks from the major flood event we had last year. And truthfully, I don't see anything that's been done. There's been a lot of studies. But truthfully, there really isn't any plan in place to help us out this year. First of all, it seems like everybody's been dragging their feet. I'm just appalled. And some of the things that weren't addressed was what happens to all the water coming off the 13th Street area that flows down along the back of the airport and right by the sewer plant into our neighborhood. Nothing's been done. Nobody said anything about that. As far as the pump situation that or proposal, I truly think they need to look at possibly a permanent pump put in with that pipe. Put in a pump station. It doesn't have to evacuate all the water. All it has to do is evacuate some of it. You know, between trying to get the reed management plan done and the lagoon dredged out and a possible pump station put in for emergency measures, maybe we won't flood again. But I know this is a big problem, and we really need to put the energy into solving it because it's been let go for way too long. I want to thank the board again, and I hope we can get some work done on this problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cobb. That will close it to public comment. Bring it back to the board. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't know if staff wanted to respond to any specifics of public comment, but I think we ought to spend just a little bit of time on the other major policy issue before us, which is our authorization of potential deliberate breaching of the South Levee. When I first heard about this concept in the floods in the Midwest over this past spring season, it seemed it's a bit of an awesome responsibility because there will be agricultural land that will be affected by this. But in terms of a tough decision, I think it's one that we have to make. I wonder if Public Works staff, they outlined the conditions under which these things might occur, the evacuations and all these things need to be accomplished. But I wonder if they could speak very briefly to exactly who is going to make these decisions once we're in an emergency situation.
Well, sort of the setup for this has been in the emergency response plan, because it's not if, it's when the levee overtops. We don't know how bad it could be. It probably couldn't be much worse than it was 10 years ago when the levee overtopped, because we had less capacity than it could handle. That really wasn't that significant of a rainfall event. Right. When that happened. So the levy, the emergency response plan, is basically to assure that as we see the water level coming up, we see moisture coming, more rainfall anticipated, it's not going down, we enact an evacuation plan even without the levee breach. We enact an activation plan that does evacuate the animals first, the people out of there, as I said, the 911 system. That has been in the plan for the last 3 years when we prepared it, because we anticipate that breach. That breach could happen just on its own. And as I mentioned, that likely in from my engineering perspective and observing the levee in the films and what we know, that the south levee will be overtopping fairly significantly at the time that the north levee would breach because of a volume of water. But we don't know what possibly could happen. There could be something else that we're not aware of. So, and I don't think it's very likely that the north levee could potentially imminently be breaching or in danger of breaching without the south levee overtopping at all. But it could.
Okay. I guess my question is a little more specific to that. Okay. You know, at a point where we contemplate putting an excavator into the south levee to open a hole, who will have approved that decision? CAO, emergency services manager?
Let us go to our CAO and
address that. Let me address that. It's typical of any major emergency is that we have an emergency hierarchy, and that involves a command group that typically would be at the Emergency Operations Center. That would certainly include Public Works, our sheriff, fire, public health, and the county administrator who acts as the emergency services director. When we come to something as important as this, that would be a decision the command group would make. It wouldn't be a decision made alone by the Public Works director. It's not the way our emergency plan works.
And that was the gist. I just want to be sure it was more than one person, whoever that might be, that we have.
It would be thoroughly discussed in terms of making evacuation orders, making sure that if we do evacuation, that it's coordinated with all the right groups, that we have the Red Cross, that we have public information. All of that goes through the Emergency Operations Center in the command group.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Gibson, Mr. Grant. Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious about one of the comments Mr. Shacker made relative to the water getting to the lagoon and potential flooding issues upstream from that. Could you?
That's part of a larger Meadow Creek, Rio Grande Creek watershed study that we would do to evaluate what can happen in there, what should happen in there. Because as we initially discussed with the state, they said the state's policy is to let these areas return to nature. Now, that comment hasn't come up since the first meeting. They basically said if the county can get permits, you can go do what you want in there to reduce the flooding risk. But I think that's going to be a major issue that maybe the state's reconsidering. I don't know where they are with that, but that's a significant issue.
But are we, I guess, where in the process are we in terms of looking into starting that process?
We will need to come back to your board and request funding for that study. It's going to be a fairly significant cost, likely along with other permanent solutions that we're going to need to look at and evaluate.
Thank you.
Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. I think one of the key things here is the significance of the reed management, as we spoke of earlier. Until we can get the reeds down to a point where we can see what's there and know what's there, we're looking at a proverbial needle in the haystack. You're not going to find it. Once we get the reeds down, we get the paths cut in, we get the channel defined, then we can look at it and say, okay, we need to do this, we need to dredge it, we need to move it, we need to do whatever. But I think that's the key thing that we need to look at, and I think it's a step in the right direction. And in addressing a comment made by Mr. Cobb about the flooding on 13th Street, we've had a little bit of rain this year, and by this time we would have had flooding there and would have had the road blocked and all those problems. But I think with the work of Public Works and the agencies involved, Caltrans, the railroad, Oceano Community Service District, we've gotten ahead of that problem, got the ditch cleaned, it flows through Povey, and it goes the way it's supposed to do. Met with staff and engineer to try to solve that problem, and again, it's one of those where you're dealing with multiple agencies, Caltrans, Corps of Engineers, Coastal Commission, and all these, and until we can get the green light from those agencies, it's going to be tough to get it done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If I could, Dean, I'd like to distill this just to, this may be putting you on the spot a little bit, but, you know, as we've had these updates, and I think Supervisor Shara and all of us have certainly taken these concerns very seriously about doing what we can to protect our citizens in Oceano from a recurrence of last winter's events. Where would you say we are? I mean, do you feel confident that we are in a much better place to prevent and respond to any such flooding as occurred last year? I mean, would you, you know, I know that we've put pressure on Public Works to continue to find solutions, and I know it's difficult because, as Supervisor Gere has pointed out, there's a lot of agencies and there are no perfect methods, but how would you characterize where we are now as opposed to last year?
Well, with the exception of the reeds being a blockage for the flow path, all our facilities are basically set up and clean to operate as best as they can. And I think we're on notice and we're on in a vigilant sense that we will be opening the flap gates and we'll be keeping them open when we know there's no risk of backflow from the ocean or from high water in Rio Grande Creek. And everything else has been located, cleaned out, a number of things to provide the as good interim measures as we can for the current system to operate successfully.
Mr. Ogren?
Certainly, Chairman Hill, members of the board, just to follow up a little bit. Obviously, still a lot of significant concerns for Oceano, and so don't want to underplay those at all. The only ditch area that I'm aware of that permits couldn't get into and work couldn't be would be the actual stuff that was on the airport. And that is then affects the flow of water from what's the street, Dean? That's
from Paso Robles and 19th Street, or that vicinity.
There's about a half a dozen properties that are just north of the airport.
Fountain Avenue.
Oh, thanks,
okay.
Jill.
Yes.
So in terms of the ditch clearing around Aloha Court and everything, some of that has done. You know, again, Joe spoke to the idea of reed management in order to help with Aloha Court flow freely to the flap gates. But I think Mark had indicated he was working with Coastal Commission, and we were not able to get emergency permits. We've been helping the airport to try to get some of the permits. So that particular ditch, we could not get emergency permits on. So Fountain Avenue, obviously, is one of the two areas in the Metal Creek area that are of significant concern.
Although, let me just add that we did clean a large culvert out about 200 feet. That was about a 42-inch culvert that was full of mud from Fountain Avenue to the lake there, Meadow Creek, and that was cleaned out.
Yeah, so there was one ditch system in there that we were not able to get permits to clean out. And again, in some respects, you know, there's some public comment that says, well, things finally started coming together at this point in time. I think the reality is we've been looking at these things. We've been doing the setup because we anticipated that we needed to be prepped in order so that we could move forward getting emergency permits back in June or July Creek. And there's rebuild up between Grand Avenue and the lagoon, and it creates the question as to whether or not the water actually starts flowing north. What's happening hydraulically there in storm events? So we're identifying the spots where we want to make sure to have observers also so that we can make sure that we're really understanding what's going on during the storm.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Meacham.
Just a quick comment, and I can see where a lot of the frustration lies. An outside agency telling us that we don't know when an emergency is. That's just ridiculous in my mind. Locally, we can figure out what needs to be done, but we have to go to somebody else to let them give us permission to tell us what we already know. Anyway.
Welcome to California.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ogren. With that, Mr. Teixeira, would you like to?
Second.
Okay. And that is to receive the update and authorize the manual breach. And we've discussed with the CAO that process of how that response would be carried out. Mr. Gibson?
Speaking to a question on the motion again in terms of direction to staff on this, about the pump and pipeline option, is that moving ahead to be installed and put on a standby mode?
We don't have permits for that. I guess we would appreciate your board's direction of if that would be a parallel evolution you would want us to advance as much as we could without permits. We could do the utility relocation, but we would have to stop there. There's some issues with why do we relocate utilities and then not put the pipe in the ground. Their parallel paths, it's another contingency. The benefit is questionable. It is positive, but it's very expensive. So I guess we'd like to have the benefit of your board's comments on that.
Again, Mr. Chairman, my thought on that was that at least the establishment of a pipeline in Juanita Street between the lagoon and the beach against future possibility, given the uncertain aspect of the reed management, I think that $85,000, as I calculated it, would be a reasonable contingency investment, but I'd entertain other colleagues' opinions on that.
Mr. Patterson, same issue?
Yeah, I question whether or not we should make that investment with the in-place piping. What did you say the total cost was? You had the cost of the pipe, which was $46,000, plus the installation.
It's roughly about $80,000.
To just put the pipe in place to have it ready to use.
But, yes.
It
would be a pipe in the street that would be empty, and we could connect on either end to it, but that's what
well,
we
and
do.
You'd need to connect to both ends,
yes,
actually,
would.
To make it functional.
Yeah. I will note that the Flood Control District did purchase a pump similar to the one that we would be renting, and we do have that pump available to use it for the Cambria Flood Control Area. It is a Flood Control District pump, could be used anywhere. We could use that pump in advance of a storm. Significant storms, we'd likely take it to Cambria. That's where it was designed to be installed. But we could then, instead of renting a pump, we would have a pump and be able to use it. We would have to buy the connecting pieces and the outlet pieces to be able to use that pump in advance of significant storms. If we saw the area of flooding in Meadow Creek rise as we did last year, we could reduce that down to a certain level.
Mm-hmm. How portable is that pump? And you'd still need the connecting pipe between the pump and the permanent piping in the street,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's on a trailer, so we can move it very easily.
Oh, okay.
But my guess would be to rent those components would probably be in the range of at least $50,000 to $75,000, just the component pieces, to hook that all up.
Okay, so
it's expensive.
You're talking $150,000.
So if we do both, if we do the reed management, is $30,000 to $40,000 for one time, and then another $80,000 to put the 24-inch pipe in Juanita Street to have it available in the event we need to pump it.
Yes.
But, again, that would be used really since we were told that it really couldn't keep up with storm flows. The idea would be to reduce the level to allow capacity in the event we had storm.
That's correct.
In the lagoon.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
This is probably a real silly question. Where would we pump this water to?
It'd be pumped onto the beach. We can't dump it into the ocean, but we can pump it onto the beach upstream of the ocean.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Sheriff?
If we're going to use this pump for emergency measures, why can't we lay the pipe on top of the road for 24 to 48 hours and possibly barricade the street and pump it and be done with it, pick up the pipe and go on, and not spend the $80,000 to $100,000 to put it in ground? This could be a one-time deal that we never use again.
The mobilization costs to bring it out and the time that it would take for us to pump are approximately 2 weeks to pump to reduce the water level about 2 feet. That's what it with running and continuously. And the cost to pump it out to
excuse me. Is there funding available in the Flood Control and Water Conservation District budget to do this?
It was approved with your board's approval for these infrastructure improvements, these temporary improvements last month in October, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
I'm on my. Yeah, I'll go to the motion maker.
We'll defer to
your colleagues' consensus is on this.
I would amend the motion to accept staff's recommendation to put the pipe in the ground, spend the money, and let's get set up to pump this in case of an emergency.
So both options.
Both options.
Is that clear, Mr. Benedix?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Yeah, I concur. I'm sorry.
Okay. Just wanted to be certain.
Yep.
Okay, with that, we'll call for the question. Madam Clerk, a roll call, please, if you could.
Mr. Teixeira.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes. Thank you. We are going to take a break, come back in about 15 minutes. Thank you.
So 11:20.
The reason I pushed on that.
We want to go ahead and put the slide on. Okay. The Los Osos landfill, just about a mile east of Los Osos, bounds Turi Road on the north. It has a creek, intermittent creek, Warden Creek, that flows along the southern boundary, if you will. And for context, the Giacomazzi site is shown on there, the Los Osos project site. The landfill is a 25-acre closed landfill site. It was installed without a lining when it was originally developed, and it was previously a quarry site. I want to give you a little bit of history on the operations and the groundwater because they're important with respect to the presentation today. Sorry, I went the wrong direction. Oh, I go back here. It's not responding. Okay. The landfill began operations in 1958. The county leased and subsequently subleased the operations to provide sanitary disposal services for the North Coast area. 30 years later, the lease ended and the county determined to cease operations at the landfill and entered a subsequent year into a new lease agreement, the county being responsible for closure and post-closure maintenance of the landfill operation. Recently, we continue as now to monitor post-closure maintenance and the corrective action in accordance with the Regional Water Quality Control Board documentation, who basically oversee the maintenance and the operation of the site. The groundwater history for the property, we initially installed three groundwater wells in 1986. The following year, we identified there were a number of contaminants. These are volatile organic compounds. I'll be referring to them as VOCs. Were detected in the groundwater adjacent to the property in 1994. Additional monitoring wells were installed because we had to determine what the size of the plume was relative to the boundary of the property or the boundary of the refuge, which is buried there. In 1998, in order to begin active remediation and removal of contaminants, a landfill gas system was installed and has been operating since that time. To illustrate the problem, the issue that we have, this is the area, the dashed area is the boundary of the buried refuse on the landfill site, and this is called the point of compliance area. It's recognized that we will have groundwater contaminants within this zone. The regional board, in accordance with our waste discharge permits, we are not allowed to have contaminants in the groundwater outside of this point of compliance or the area where the refuse is buried. So our problem is that the groundwater under the landfill migrates, as groundwater does, and in this case it migrates down toward the southwest. And with it, it carries the contaminants that are in the buried refuse or that leak through the buried refuse, and it migrates to the southwest. Now, it doesn't continue to migrate indefinitely. The shaded area to the southwest shows the area where we have identified basically a number of contaminants, VOCs, which are in the groundwater. And the regional board compares the level of those contaminants to the background groundwater level. So we have two wells adjacent to the landfill that monitor the existing groundwater quality. We compare those to the groundwater contaminants disposed of that way. This is a sort of a real-time picture from Google that shows the landfill from a semi-aerial view. And the orange area at the bottom of your screen is approximately the location of the contaminated zone that we're trying to address.
Dean, is that the creek running just below
the microphone?
Excuse me, may I, Mr. Chair? Is that the creek running just below the and through the below that lower road and through the contaminant zone?
Yes, the creek runs between the two bottom roads, basically through the center of that, along the bottom edge of that orange boundary there.
Mm-hmm.
And are we seeing surface water contamination?
No. No, we don't have surface water contamination. The groundwater is approximately 20 to 22 feet below the surface, and we don't have any wells in the vicinity that are affected, and we don't have groundwater impact here. In 2005, subsequent to our monitoring and reporting, which we do semi-annually to the regional board, the regional board said, you guys have to do something. It's not being cleaned up, and we need some more active remediation being done in addition to the gas system, which they agree has been successful. A report was done in 2006 by an expert consultant, and the conclusion that they came up with was a bioenhancement remediation program could be investigated to see if we could inject media into wells that would speed up the natural degradation process of these VOCs. They also recommended that we improve the landfill cap cover to reduce the amount of water that settled on or percolated down in through the landfill, which contribute obviously to movement of the contaminants into groundwater. They also recommended that we continue with our groundwater sampling and monitoring program. As a result of that report, we did ask the regional board to grant us an adjustment in the levels of the contaminants above background level to less than water quality, drinking water quality level. The board would not consider that request until we had made some active progress here in investigating an additional corrective action scenario. So based on that, the engineering feasibility study identified five alternatives. Just briefly, one was the enhanced cover, which we have done to reduce percolation through the groundwater. The second one was a air sparging and vapor extraction system. That's IAS, VES. Basically, that's injecting oxygen to eliminate the portions of the VOCs. And the cost for that system was approximately $3 million at the time that this study was done. The bioenhancement option was shown as a total cost of about $700,000. I'll mention that a little bit more because we did some pilot testing on that as a result of this study. The MERD was a metal-enhanced, basically an installation of a trench with metal filings in it, and the trench would cover the length of the off-site water mitigation. As the water runs through it, it reacts with the metal, and the VOCs are yielded to a non-toxic form. But you can imagine a 40-foot deep trench. I don't know how long this would be, fairly expensive, estimated about $1.3 million. And the last alternative that they felt was feasible was what we call intrinsic remediation, which is a really neat word for natural remediation, just its natural processes. So there were some other alternatives investigated, and I will mention that the pump and treat system, which was the topic of our issue today, was considered. It wasn't deemed feasible or as feasible as bioenhancement at the time the study was done because of the character of the soil structure underground in the contaminant area. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. As a result of this 2006 study, we did do a bioenhancement pilot study, which basically involved drilling seven wells and installing molasses or similar media into the ground, pumping it into the ground, and then observing how fast that the contamination could be reduced relative to the timing we had seen. The examination or the results of that were evaluated, and the conclusion was that this system was not feasible to make a large project bioenhancement study or implementation system. Generally, this was a pilot to figure out if on a mini scale it would work. Ultimately, if it worked, we'd do a larger scale project. The conclusions of the study were that it did provide a small to moderate volume of groundwater impact. It was extremely difficult injecting this material into the wells that we had and would have been extremely more difficult to do it on a larger scale project. So the conclusion was that it was specifics. But we continue with that. I did want to mention that in the 13 years that we have operated the flare, based on a couple of years of research, we've removed about 1.5 tons of these VOCs by burning them through the flare system. So it's pretty effective. We have also looked at, during this process, expanding that flare system or expanding the gas collection system, and we're pretty much, we've got about a mile of piping on the site and about 20 wells. So it's pretty well covered, and that doesn't seem to be a very plausible option to increase that opportunity significantly. The semi-annual reporting we do to the regional board keeps them in touch of what we're doing and where we are in the status. Now, the regional board concurred with our intrinsic remediation program to the extent that we develop these things. They kind of call us and say, you need to do such and such. We review it with them. We send them reports, and we don't generally get a response. Our response is usually no if we get something. Otherwise, we say, this is what we're doing unless you advise us otherwise. And that's where we've been for the last few years with our systems that we've done. Just a little bit of background on the budgets for the landfill costs. Our total operating budget is just over $300,000 a year. Of that, just under $100,000 for site maintenance, the monitoring and reporting of the groundwater, air quality, and storm runoff that Cary does is almost $150,000 a year, and the balance is for licensing, permitting fees, and other administrative work that we do associated with that reporting. And these costs are funded by the county through the County General Fund. Now, earlier this year, the regional board called Cary and they said, based on the reporting we've seen, your contaminant levels are not going down fast enough. We determined that the regional board is concerned that since the 2005-2006 study was done, we understand that they've been observing this and they've been looking for contaminant levels to be decreasing. Basically, they have sort of drawn a line now and said they're not decreasing fast enough, so you have to do something. So the little chart here that I'll blow up on the next slide is just intended to illustrate that starting on the in 1991, we started tracking contaminants from six different wells in the contaminant area. The left bar, the left axis, is basically contaminant level, and it starts at 1991 on the bottom and goes to the right to 2011. So the first half of the graph shows some contaminants going down, some going up a little bit, and there's a break there because that break is where we installed the gas collection system. So the initial installation of that system dropped some of the contaminant levels, kind of flattened them out, and as I was looking at that, I thought, well, some of those wells actually are not reducing as fast as they did before the gas collection system was installed. But overall, except for a couple of wells that go up and down, we're seeing somewhat of a downward increase, but I think as you see them flattening out in the last 3 or 4 years, the regional board is looking for those to go down faster and quite a bit lower.
And if I could, Dean, what's the, and Mr. Chairman, thank you, what's the allowable level of these total VOCs?
The allowable level is background level by our permit.
Okay.
So, and there are none of these contaminants are in background.
Okay.
And
so
we have
zero is
the level. That's correct.
Okay.
And there are quite a few of them. There's a bunch of them, and I can't pronounce most of them. So based on this, and it was part of our task to find out why the regional board is now asking for this. And I hopefully explained to you that they're not seeing this decrease. So we had discussions with Golder Associates about options that we had. They do our semi-annual monitoring, and they're very well versed in California's landfill requirements, operations, and regulations. And our discussion with them and with the regional board sort of yielded an approach that what we should do is investigate a pump and treat system. And conceptually, what this would be evaluating drilling a few wells, installing pumps to pump that out of the ground into a holding tank, through a kind of an intermittent slug, we take that through a small water treatment system, and then we would dispose of the clean water. The idea behind this is that this is a fairly low technology type of system that's necessary, that could be utilized. We want, in our discussions, to determine that we really need to revisit the 2006 engineering feasibility study to look at current technology as it applies to the previous options that I showed you, and ensure that this is feasible with respect to cost and feasible with respect to benefit, that would give us a significant benefit. So our request today to the board is a system, if the study indicates that installation of a pilot plant to determine after a year or two what kind of significant reduction VOCs would have, we're estimating that the cost of that pilot plant would be approximately $200,000 to $250,000 to install that. And that would be just expansion of the well field extraction system. Likely the initial sizing of the facilities we put in would be usable to use for a permanent system. We're not talking about a 100,000-gallon tank or something. We're talking probably about maybe a 5,000-gallon tank at the largest size, and then a treatment system which would be able to handle on a kind of a slug basis to be able to treat this water and initially haul the water off-site. Because recirculating this water back into Warden Creek would take probably a three-year permit to do, and we don't anticipate there's a lot of water we'd be getting out of this system. So that's the initial look. If we went to a long-term system that was a permanent system, we're estimating it's about $250,000 to $250,000 in addition to the initial pilot plant costs. So today's recommendation is to obtain your approval of development of the technical pilot plan for the Los Osos landfill by a budget adjustment in the amount of $30,000.
Okay. Several questions. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In terms of the budgeting of this, I do recall in our annual budget we show an amount going to the Los Osos landfill. It's just a responsibility that we have to remediate a less than modern facility. Mr. Grant, can you tell us a little bit about the amount? I can't bring it to mind. I heard $300,000 per year, and we have a reserve built up. Where are we financially on the whole?
Well, the operational cost right now is built into the general fund. It's a general fund cost.
As its own fund center. Yeah.
When we found out that we had to mitigate some of these issues in 98 and whenever that was, at the time, we were obligated to set up a reserve fund as part of one of the state requirements. So we have in the neighborhood of about $415,000 in that reserve fund right now, and we're recommending you use the $30,000 from that reserve at this point in time.
Okay, so that's where this funding would come. And I guess, Mr. Benedix, in terms of the action before us today, we're assessing the feasibility of a pump and treat system, but is that being examined against alternatives? I mean, by your analysis from the 06 report, it looks like this is sort of our only option. Are we really wondering whether this is going to be done or not done?
Yes, we are, because there's limited benefits in this. The ability for us to pump water out of any well is pretty limited. But it's probably the least of a number of options that would provide us minimal corrective action. On a cost-benefit, the 2006 study assessed those issues, and there was really marginal success in all of the options based on our soil structure down below. So unless we were to jump to a $3 million or $4 million metal shaving-type trench system, which the regional board is not pushing us, they're not pushing us to do expensive high-tech solutions. They want to see some reconsideration of current technology and assessment of that and some kind of activity that will either prove that the intrinsic remediation that we continue is virtually as effective as maybe lower technology tasks. And that's sort of the project that we're looking at advancing.
Do we understand or do we have an estimate of sort of the natural progression of this landfill? Is it going to be putting off VOCs for the rest of our lives and more, or what?
The 2006 study estimated that there was something in the range of 30 to 90 years that it would take to remediate the significant VOCs to a background level.
Intrinsically.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Beecham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of along the same lines, but on the second to the last slide, talking about the estimated cost of the pilot pump and treat program and then the estimated long-term additional pump costs, I would assume that the estimated long-term additional pump and treat costs, that kind of goes without saying we're going to have to do this at some point.
We don't see any reduced pressure to do something in addition.
Okay. And so I guess my question goes more to, is there a cost savings by implementing the initial pilot pump and treat program, but go ahead and take into consideration starting the long-term additional pump costs and everything? Do we do it now or do we do it later? It seems to me that, is there a cost savings anywhere by doing them both?
The study that they're going to do will include a conceptual facility. We don't know that yet. We have a lot of information now that I think that we'll be able to come up with a good perspective to give to your board and review with council to make sure we can address all avenues that are appropriate before we take the next step. I think we're just kind of hesitant to do that now.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Patterson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benedix, just wanted to be clear on the $30,000 that you're requesting. You talk about it installing or doing a pilot study, and then you also call it a pilot plan. It's more than just a plan. It's an actual test to see if this technology is working. Or
no.
What are we buying for the $30,000? Are we going to get any actual on-site testing, or is it just the plan of what we could do?
The plan will basically reevaluate the options that are currently available technologically to reduce VOCs. It will look more in detail at the pump and treat system and provide the benefits and the consequences of that and give us a preliminary design plan for what a pump and treat system would effectively cost full to implement as a pilot study and the full-on cost of that to implement it as a full
So then, in order to know if this technology is going to work, we actually have to invest another $200,000 or so to put in a pilot plant and
that's correct.
Operate it, basically.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did you say, Mr. Benedix, that we have maximized our ability to do gas recovery within the present system? No further wells might extract more that would then be less than the groundwater?
Yes, both of the consultants and the regional board during our technical discussions indicated that we're pretty much maximized on our flare.
Okay.
Mr. Reacham? Just quickly, you may have answered this and I might have missed it, but you mentioned that on this chart here that shows where the direction of the flow.
Yes.
It's not going to continue, you said?
No, the groundwater, I'm not sure about the speed of the groundwater underground, but the groundwater continues to the southwest.
Okay.
And we have wells beyond our point of contamination, and those groundwater wells don't show any contamination there. And the water certainly continues to go to the west. So we know we have a very stable boundary of the limits of contamination. The regional board basically wants us to actually not only they want us to actively minimize it, but they told us they want the contamination to go back into the landfill. So that's a little bit of a problem for us to make water go uphill, if you will. So, but that's what they want us to do by permit compliance.
I mean, is there any what is the reasoning for the decline of the contamination?
If the natural processes in that area do eat up the VOCs, basically. Whether it has to do with the creek and the flow, I don't really know. But the soil structure.
Put our monitoring wells out a little further away from the landfill.
Unfortunately, yeah, we can't expand the point of compliance.
No, yes. You can't move it.
Well, that's where I was going, but okay. Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. Mr. Benedix, yesterday in staff meeting, if my memory serves me correctly, the majority of the water that we're going to be collecting is water that's actually condensation that's occurring underneath the cap of the landfill. Is that correct?
It is actually physically the groundwater.
Okay. So we've got contaminants that are leaking into the groundwater.
Yes, they're moving vertically down into where the groundwater table is, and then they flow horizontally in the groundwater to the area where we would collect them with this system.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to open it up to the public now. I have one request to speak. Ms. Gwen Taylor, please.
Good
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor. Perhaps I am what might be considered the past coming to fruition. For years as a resident, for almost 40, my husband and I asked that the water below that dump or landfill be tested. And we went to the county public health, not only to the person who was in charge at the time, but subsequently to those that have taken charge without any benefit. It has always been, oh, don't worry about it. It's not going anyplace. Well, we found through listening and also observing that water does run downhill. And it also seeks water if it is going downhill. Or lake goes into the estuary. Voila! We have a problem with the estuary and contamination. The water from that dump landfill cannot all sink into the cap. It will go downhill for all of the requirements by the regional board to make you do something. I commend your engineering firms for their innovation. Perhaps they're thinking out of the box for a change. But we do need to know that that water is staying on site and it is not going anyplace else, whether it be underground or whether it be runoff.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. That'll close it to public comment and bring it back to the board. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This goes into the file of things we have to do, so I will move staff's recommendation.
I'll second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Gibson, seconded by Supervisor Patterson. Any further discussion on this? If not, a roll call, please, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes, thank you. Okay, appreciate it. Mr. Benedict, Ms. Grayton. Let's go to the next item, Madam Clerk.
That would be item 17, a hearing to consider the annual report and action plan prepared in conformance with Title 29, Affordable Housing Fund, and to consider an annual adjustment of the in-lieu and housing impact fee schedule of Title 29. Also to consider a request for use of alternative publication procedures as authorized by Government Code Section 25124. This item was introduced November 1st, 2011.
Thank you. Mr. Bench.
Thank you.
Sure, your microphone's on there.
Here we go. Thank you and good morning to the Board of Supervisors. I'm Ted Bench with the County Planning Department, and I want to present to you the Title 29 Annual Report, Action Plan, and the consideration of the whether or not to increase the Title 29 fees. So let's just start with the action or the annual report. The annual report tells us how much money has been collected in Title 29 fees, how much was spent, and what's available. The amount that we've collected was a little over $7,300 this year. The amount spent was a little over $4,500, which leaves us about $39,000 in the fund that can be spent. Last year, the board directed that a little bit of that money be spent on helping affordable housing projects with their either their construction cost or their building permit fees. And that's how the $4,500 was spent on a sweat equity project located in the Pomo. That money was used to help 11 houses with their building permit fees. I'm racing through this, and I hope if there's any questions at any point that you stop me. But moving on to the action plan. The action plan, as I said a minute ago, shows that we have a little over $39,000 in Title 29 fees that can be spent on affordable housing projects. Most of this money has to be spent on actual construction costs. It cannot be spent on related costs such as building permit fees. This table on the screen shows a little bit more about this $39,000 that's available. The top bar you see is called in lieu fees, and it shows that there's about $5,800 in lieu fee that is in the fund, and it is the flexible fee, the one that could be spent on construction related costs. But that next bar down below, housing impact fees, that's where most of this $39,000 came from, and that's the inflexible fee, the one that has to be spent on actual construction of affordable housing units. This chart also shows a breakdown of how much is available for each of those areas of the county where the fees came from, because Title 29 requires that the fees be spent in the same community or within the same area of the county that that generated the fees. So in North County, there's roughly about $12,700 available. In South County, there's roughly $4,800 available. And in Central County, the San Luis Obispo City area, there's roughly $21,000 in funds that are available to spend to do that. To bend the fees down within 5 years of when they were collected, we suggest now that the money be spent on eligible affordable housing projects, just like last year where $4,500 went out to help pay the building permit fees for 11 affordable housing units. What we suggest, as you see on the screen, are three projects in various areas of the county where the fees could be spent. These are all projects that are qualified low-income or moderate-income housing units that are being built by nonprofit developers. They are ready to go. They have either started construction already or will break ground within the 2012, so we know that the funds will be spent down timely. And again, I'm racing through a little bit. Now I would like to cover the subject of the annual fee adjustments. When the fund was created in 2008, actually the fund goes along with our inclusionary housing ordinance, which entitles the county to collect the fees from both residential and commercial development. A five-year phasing program was adopted with that fee schedule. We are still at year one, as you know, because the economy has hit all sectors of our housing market and other sections of the county economy in a hard way that at this point in time it would be difficult to go from year one to year two or follow in our five-year schedule. So what the board did last year is simply add the construction cost increase that we saw in the previous year, which was 4%. This year we recommend, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. When you look at fee adjustments, there's four options that you can look at. Option one is to make no change to the fee schedule at all. Just leave it at year one. Option two would be to repeat what the county did last year, which was to stay at year one but to add the construction cost increase. We've only seen this year a very minor increase in construction costs, less than 1%, actually. So on the screen, what you see is a table that shows you what that fee increase would mean for, say, a single-family house. It would be an increase of about $33 above what today's fees are. For a 10,000-square-foot store, the fee increase would be about $40 above what it is at today's fee schedule. Option three would be to increase the fee to year two of the five-year phase-in plan, and option four would be along with going to increase it to year two and to add the construction cost increase. The staff recommends that the board consider repeating the action that was taken last year, which is to leave the fee schedule at year one and just to add the construction cost increase. And the resolution prepared for your board reflects that option. So to summarize the presentation, the staff recommends that your board accept the annual report that I described earlier, receive and accept the annual report regarding the action plan, that you adopt the resolution that would allow the fund to be spent on the three eligible projects, the $39,000 be spent on the three eligible projects that were described earlier, and that regarding the fee schedule increase, that you adopt the resolution that would leave the fee schedule at year one and just add a less than 1% construction cost increase. The only other action I would add to this is that in the interest of saving publishing cost, that the board direct the clerk of the county clerk to post these resolutions and documents in the county offices so that they're available for public review. The alternative action would be you can direct the staff to make changes to the two resolutions that we've described to you and bring those changes back on January 17th. That concludes my presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bench.
Just have the clerk's office post the resolutions and the ordinance changes and the reports that we presented today so that the public can review those rather than printing them in the newspaper.
Okay, stop talking, Ted. Perhaps Mr. McNulty would like to weigh in so that we can.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I don't believe that we are proposing to amend Title 29 today, Ted, so I don't think that there's need for what you're talking about. I think we're only proposing to adopt resolutions which will amend the fee, and the way our program is set up, the program was established by way of ordinance, but the fees are increased by annual resolutions or left the same, whatever the board decides to do. So the resolutions themselves do not need to be published. So.
Okay. Let's see. Let's turn that frown upside down.
There we go.
All right.
I'm here.
Let me go to the public on this before we confuse our clerk, which we never want to do. Mr. Bunin, followed by Mr. Brown, please.
Jerry Bunin, Government Affairs Director, Home Builders Association. We're basically here to support the staff recommendation. We're about the same condition we were in last year, only much worse. We're on record pace, fewest number of new homes built in the county in more than 20 years. So we would appreciate it if you didn't make it worse by raising the fees. We don't feel there's a lot of rush to get the ordinance fully implemented. It's pretty unlikely that very many projects are going to be coming through for at least 2 to 5 years, so not a lot lost. Right now the market's taking care of a lot of affordability issues. Homes are selling for a median price of about $50,000 to $100,000 less than we can build that home for. I feel like I'm a year behind every time I talk to you on this. But based on what we talked about last year, that when things pick up, and my builders tell me they will eventually, we are not going to expect you to take a five-year phase-in because you've been very kind on that so far. What we might ask would be a two-step phase-in. So we had a little bit of time to make sure the recovery was really taking hold, but we're not going to expect you to go 5 years from whenever we start. But if you do choose to start today, we will still appreciate the fact that it's a pretty fair ordinance, and you've been very fair on this so far. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bunin. Mr. Brown?
Mike Brown, CoLab. We think this is a ordinance that probably ought to be abolished. We realize you're following some bad state-enabling legislation here. It probably costs more to do the report that you have, monitor this program, and execute it than the $39,000 that you have to give out to whatever projects are out there. I mean, you might be better off just appropriating it or $100,000 from your better fund balance or something, rather than going through all the wickets and things that the program requires. The real issue here is that this is a tax posing as a fee. You're saying to one segment of society, a small segment, home builders who are building six houses or more, we're going to tax you so that then we can take that money and give it to somebody else because the marketplace is not generating enough affordable rental units out there. And that's true. But the problem is scale. And in talking to large-scale apartment house builders over time, a real effective project that can deliver, you know, multiple bedroom units for families in a way that looks good and fits in with the community and is not some, you know, Playa del Rey, Marina del Rey, L.A. monstrosity, you need about 300 units in that development. So the real issue here is in your land use plan and zoning. Where are the places that you could achieve in a sensitive way a scale that would be enticing so that you could, at least when the market begins to recover, that you could produce these on a scale and in a way that look good? And I'm not suggesting like that big building out on Broad Street in San Luis Obispo, which is pretty massive for the neighborhood out there, but things that are nestled in that are...
...investing with two nonprofits that can actually get these units built and leverage other funding to make it happen, to build affordable and workforce housing for the community. And I think, given the circumstances, it's the best... use of the funding that we do have available to help these other organizations build the housing that we need in this county. I want to thank Mr. Bunin for his support and his organization's support of the staff's recommendation and the offer to, once the industry turns around, that we will be able to fully phase this in, hopefully in a shorter period of time. So with that, I'll move staff's recommendation.
Okay, moved by Supervisor Patterson, seconded by Supervisor Meacham. Under discussion, Mr. Gibson, did you want
to? Just to thank Mr. Bunin for his understanding of and I think very, very fair appraisal of the need eventually to get this program underway. I certainly do understand the situation of the moment, and I will support the motion.
Okay, and the motion also includes Mr. Bench's
No,
it doesn't.
No. All right. Doesn't have any.
All right, thank goodness. I don't want to go back there. The clerk is still laughing. All right, Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Bench. Thank you, Mr. Lilly. And one more item we have here before our closed session is Madam Clerk.
That would be item 18, a hearing to consider, one, the annual road improvement fee reports for the fee areas of Ava, Los Osos, South County, Templeton, North Coast, and San Miguel. Two, adoption of resolutions continuing the fees of the County Road Improvement Fee Program in Los Osos, South County, San Miguel, North Coast, and Templeton. Three, adopt the resolution decreasing the fees for the Avila Road Improvement Fee Program. And four, adopt the mitigated negative declarations for the fee programs.
Okay, thank you. I see Mr. Chapman here, and he's calling up his PowerPoint show. And as he does so, we'll ask one of our board members to sing a little background music.
I was going to move to approve staff's recommendation.
Well, we could do that. We could. Mr. Chapman, are you ready? He is ready. He's not comfortable yet, but he's ready.
Hi, I'm Ryan Chapman with the San Luis Obispo County Public Works Department, and I'm here to present the update for the road impact fees. The purpose of the fee program is to eliminate cumulative traffic impacts under the general plan, identify capacity improvements needed as required by your board policies, and establish a fee for development to pay for those mitigations. This year, over previous years, we've included an environmental document with the updates. Historically, the environmental work was done as the projects were being developed. Recent case law indicates that these programs would benefit from having environmental documentation earlier in the process, and this will further define the VRF programs as a mitigation measure for new development. In the North County, we've got three fee areas: the North Coast, San Miguel, and Templeton. This table shows the account balances as of the fiscal year. The Templeton AB account has made all its payments for the certificates of participation and is on track to make the payments over the next fiscal year. This is the current fee schedule for the North County fee areas. No changes are being proposed. There were two fee appeals in the North County fee area. Both of them were denied by your board. In the South County, we also have three fee areas: Los Osos, Avila, and then the South County area. This is the account balance for the South County area fee areas. And the Napomo Area 1 includes the payments from the Woodlands. This is the current South County fee structure. There is a proposed change to the Avila Valley fee area, and that change is due to the traffic signal that was recently constructed. It was originally a project to be paid by the fee, but funds were made available by PG&E. Since the project was paid for entirely with those funds, we are recommending that the traffic signal be removed from the fee program and the fee be reduced by 7% to $3,846. There was one fee appeal in the South County. Your board denied the appeal, but deferred the time of the fee being due until the occupancy permit was issued. This is a list of the current projects we're working on. Our recommended actions are that you receive the attached fee reports, you adapt the resolution decreasing the fees in the Avila area and adopting the mitigated negative deck for that fee program, and adopt the resolutions continuing